welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on this week's programme, do you enjoy your city?
Telling them about and explaining to them this new way of designing cities, which we're calling living urbanism, which is basically the connection of just humans, nature and the built environment.
We'll examine the plans to bring a revitalising living Ruth to the heart of Northland, New Zealand, and how it's all happening due to years of campaigning. Then we turn to the UK and hear from the woman trying to change the way we navigate our streets, hoping to make it a much more enjoyable experience for all. And finally, a tool to measure just how tranquil our urban spaces really are. All that coming up over the next 30 minutes, right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. So, welcome to today's programme. Now, Friedensreich Hundertwasser was an Austrian-born New Zealand artist and architect whose best known work is the Hundertwasser House in Vienna. In 1993, while living in New Zealand, he submitted a design for an arts centre to be built in Northland. The plans were rejected, but not forgotten. Following years of volunteers running campaigns, the building is set to become a reality, expected to open in 2020. A diehard opponent of any standardisation, he designed the Hundertwasser Art Centre for Northland to be bright, curvy, and in line with his philosophy of nature, identity, architecture, and art. And, like most of his buildings, this includes an ambitious living roof. Our New Zealand contributor, Claire Urban, met with senior landscape and urban planning consultant Chloe Avery in her Auckland office at Foresight. Chloe is leading the team and they spoke about the essence of working on a living roof.
I originally got into living roofs in London. I was working at the Environment Agency for a number of years as a major projects officer. So I was looking after developments and trying to work with the developers to make sure they were as sustainable as possible. And the one system that could be included into every development but would have multifunctional benefits was living roofs. It's just bringing biophilia back into our cities. So when we're taking what we're calling in New Zealand a living urbanism approach, it's about connecting people, nature and the built environment and create spaces that are not only beautiful, but they're resilient.
So tell us about this Hundertwasser project that you're working on.
So the Hundertwasser project is a art centre and Māori art gallery planned to be open in 2020. It was designed by Hundertwasser himself, I think on a napkin, but initial concept drawings have now been progressed to a point where building consent plans have now been put in. It's about 980 square metres and the living roof is going to be quite fantastic. It's an intensive green roof and we're using locally found regionally specific plants and trees from Northland but also from the offshore islands. We've also got a lot of endangered species as well. So we've got the rarest tree on the world. I've managed to get 9 of them on the roof, or planned to be on the roof. So that's the Pinantia. And all of these have been grown at the moment. Most of the trees are already around 3 metres in height. So the design of this roof is you will be walking in the forest. In terms of the biodiversity, we have a huge list of plants and tens of thousands of plants under planting going in, and it's going to be quite an experience and an education as to what Northland in New Zealand has in terms of a plant palette, but also what species are actually threatened in decline and really a conservation kind of screaming point for what this community has and what our land is providing, but what we also need to start protecting. So the roof has been designed to have a live load of 200 people walking through it with sculptures. And Hundertwasser actually wanted to create a living roof where you could kind of walk through this forest and come across fruit trees and pick your own fruit and eat it. So there are a number of fruiting trees and we've got early season, mid-season and late season apples. So you will actually experience the roof, but also be able to have a snack.
Let's bring it back to living roofs themselves, stepping away from the Hundavasa for a moment. What about the business of living roofs? Is it something that is getting a bit of investment at the moment? Is there a business in living roofs?
Internationally, yes. In Aotearoa, no. We've kind of been a little bit behind the eight ball in terms of living roofs. We had a little slight architectural fascination and love of living walls. Obviously, they're aesthetically incredibly pleasing and really great for biophilia, especially within office spaces. But unfortunately, in terms of sustainability, they don't really stack up. I would say they're more art installations as opposed to anything that's hitting social, economic and environmental issues. So we haven't had any policy to date or any guidance. And I think that has left us in this kind of unknown area of not being given the information to disseminate to people, developers, architects, to include them on buildings. So unfortunately, we're still holding on to a few of the myths that green roofs are leaky and you'll have problems with fire and they're too heavy, which isn't the case. If we're designing a normal commercial building within New Zealand, you can put on a green roof without any extra structural loading requirements.
How does a living roof give resilience to a building?
If we start designing living roofs into the landscape and onto buildings, we're actually extending the roof life by two or three times. We're actually giving resilience not only to the building but to our cities, because they're attenuating probably 90% of all stormwater that falls on top of them. So that stormwater obviously doesn't end up in our pipes and then in our rivers and in our seas. Biophilia, they're giving us a place to kind of connect back in with nature and plants and bees and invertebrates.
Do you know, I mean, just broadly, how many living roofs there are in New Zealand?
There's really not that many. I would say there's definitely less than probably 50 throughout the country, which is quite sad, but it's also quite exciting because I think we can really start giving people a lot of information about our plants, our plant palettes, biodiversity, biophilia, linking it in with urban design and maybe telling them about and explaining to them this new way of designing cities, which we're calling living urbanism, which is basically the connection of just humans, nature, and the built environment, as opposed to normal urbanism, which kind of segregates things a little bit too much. We can get people excited about all of that stuff, and then we'll actually end up with living roofs that are locally significant, using plants that are found locally and locally significant, indigenous plants, creating habitats for animals, bees, birds, just everything that creates an environment which is meant to be in Aotearoa. So I'm excited. I feel like we're starting this process a little bit late, but watch this space. I think we'll be designing roofs that are incredible, like Hundavasa, which really push the limits, which create these elevated enclaves for our species that we can talk about biodiversity freely and we can really understand the effects of biophilia. I'm used to every single weekend wanting to pack up the tent, our kids, and go out to a beach and camp and get my feet on the soil. But what we want to do through living urbanism is to be able to go leave your office at lunchtime and get your feet on the soil, have that connection with nature and get a sense of place, get that far outlook. In Auckland, we're in these little boxes, and yet if we could get on the roof, we could see the harbour and the volcanoes and Rangitoto and actually get a sense of place, and that's placemaking. So I think we're at the start of a really, really, really exciting road ahead.
That was Chloe Avery, who's the Senior Landscape and Urban Planning Consultant for Foresight, speaking to our very own contributor, Claire Urban. There's not really one simple way of measuring how happy people are in any given place, but what about how relaxed they are? This question led to the creation of the Tranquility Rating Prediction Tool, or TRAPT, which measures just how relaxing urban spaces really are. Greg Watts is a professor of environmental acoustics at the University of Bradford, and he led the team conducting this research. His hope is that it will become a valuable tool for city halls and planners across the globe. He joined me a little bit earlier.
It's one of those jelly-like concepts, isn't it? But it does include concepts of being away from it all, being in environments that are natural with low man-made noise. It's basically those two factors, I think, that make for a sort of tranquil environment. So we've used that in developing our prediction equation, which is TRAPT, Tranquility Rating Prediction Tool.
Now, before we look at that tool, could you just perhaps also explain to our listeners why you felt it was time that we had such an ability to measure tranquility?
I think it's because a lot of soundscape research, if I can call it that, doesn't seem to have any practical end. And we felt that one of the positive things about soundscape research is to develop ways of improving urban soundscapes. And so we got onto this idea of, okay, reducing noise, number one, but what are the other factors that might contribute to a tranquil environment? And so then we started looking more deeply at that in a laboratory setting to begin with, but then we validated it with survey work later on.
Now, tell me about the actual tool, this TRAPT tool. How does this work as a set of, you know, value judgments for deciding if an area is tranquil?
So we do a rating on a 0 to 10 scale, where 10 is extremely tranquil, let's say, and 0 is not tranquil at all. And the tool actually is like a prediction equation. It's an engineering approach, if you like. So we try and quantify the factors that affect this rating. And by doing a number of experiments in the laboratory, we've come out with this idea of two main factors. One is the level of man-made noise, and I must stress it's man-made noise, so natural sound isn't counted in that. And also the percentage of nature or natural features that you can see around you. And it's those two main factors that are able to predict the tranquility rating. There are other things, for example, if there is litter or graffiti about, that will tend to lower it. And if there's the right sort of water sounds, that can improve it slightly. But normally that's only plus or minus one scale point on this 0 to 10 scale.
So most of the things you're looking at are to do with sound. You reference there graffiti, which is obviously a silent detractor from our day in many ways. But on the whole, you're looking at actually that man-made audio world that bumps into our lives.
That's only 50% of it, because the other half of the equation, which is almost just as important, is actually what we see. So it's a multi-sensory concept. It's being surrounded by nature as much as it is about reducing the man-made noise. And it's those two factors together. So in a sense, you can trade one off against the other. So if you've got a slightly noisy environment, you can actually improve it by greening the immediate neighbourhood. So what you look at does inform your overall impression of tranquility.
So that fascinates me, because when I saw your list, I was imagining that the greenery, the trees were going to be in the mix because they deflected sound or they reduced its impact. But in fact, you're saying that even if you hear the car noise still, but you get a better view from your window, your life feels a little bit more tranquil.
Yes, absolutely it does. And there's been a number of studies that have shown that effect. You know, people who have a nice outlook, say on a park or something like that, will assess the noise differently. And then there's quite a groundbreaking study in the mid-80s by a guy called Ulrich, and he was looking at recovery of patients. They had the same operation, but they were divided into two samples. One sample had a view out the window of a nice avenue of trees, and the other patients were looking onto essentially a blank wall. And they looked at recovery rates and the degree of painkillers that these patients needed. And on both counts, it was much more positive for those who had the pleasant outlook. And then he replicated that, or sort of quantified it, by going into the laboratory and exposing volunteers to different types of videos, you know, nature video, a video showing traffic, people in a shopping mall. And actually, bit naughty, but he stressed them by showing them a training film that showed a lot of blood and gore. So using physiological measures of heart rate and galvanic skin response, he showed that they were stressed. And then he separated them into three groups, and each group saw a different video. And lo and behold, those who saw the nature film, their indicators came down to a base level much more quickly than the other two groups who were watching the traffic or people in a shopping mall.
Are you hoping that city halls and planners and architects are going to use your tool to think about how they make future developments a little bit more tranquil?
It would be really nice if that was the case. I was involved, actually. I gave a presentation to a planning group in Christchurch in New Zealand. You're probably aware that they've had devastating earthquakes in recent years. So they've got, in a sense, a blank sheet, and they're wondering how to put the centre of the city together again. So I think they were quite receptive to the idea of ensuring that there was plenty of greenery and also low levels of man-made noise. So they've ended up with a plan which is central business district is fairly green. It's got avenues of trees. This is in the plan. I don't think it's quite there yet, but around this quite tight central area, there are areas of parkland. So there's like a ring around the city centre, so people can access this greenery quite easily. They can walk to the green spaces and get some relief from city stress.
That was Greg Watts, who's a professor of environmental acoustics at the University of Bradford. And here's some other stories that we're following this week. This week it was revealed that Donald Trump would like to have a military parade in Washington, D.C., one with lots of hardware, tanks and troops. He apparently got excited about the idea after attending the Bastille Day celebrations in Paris with his fellow president, Emmanuel Macron. While the idea may appeal as a way to trumpet US military might to the world, the folks in City Hall are already pushing back. One of the reasons? Highway repair. Okay, it's not as sexy as missiles and munitions, but for the urbanist, it's a worry. Armoured vehicles running on tracks will rip up the roads and cause structural damage that could leave weeks of repairs as the biggest outcome of the swaggerama. Perhaps Mr. Trump should get some tips from friends in Moscow on the do's and don'ts of the military parade, or stage the whole thing in Mar-a-Lago. But this week there's a more pressing and hopefully enjoyable date in the diary, the opening of the Winter Olympics in South Korea. While most of the snowy entertainment is coming from Pyeongchang, the games are putting the spotlight on the entire country. And Monocle has just been to South Korea for an in-depth country survey that's running in our March issue. While there, we caught up with Park Won-soon, the pro-pedestrian mayor of Seoul, who's radically shifted how the city sees quality of life by focusing on reusing existing structures, not knocking them down. And he told Monocle, the quality of life of ordinary citizens is made up of very trivial, very small things, and through an accumulation of small things, a big revolutionary change can come about. Wise words. Read more in the March issue about this modest but effective urbanist visionary. Finally, to Sydney. Now, while the city may be one of the handsomest in the world, in recent years it's gained itself a reputation for being, well, dull. Punishing state laws meant to crack down on drunks and alcohol-fueled violence have been so severe that they've killed off the city's nightlife. But now Lord Mayor Clover Moore wants to salvage the nighttime economy and is out hiring a panel of creative nightlife advisors. But until the laws are eased, it's likely that Sydney will remain more a flat whites than cocktail town. As we've heard earlier in the programme, high levels of traffic can have a negative impact in the way that we experience our cities. And often the reason that people don't want to walk or cycle is down to this melee of vehicles. Dealing with other road users is never an easy task. But to help Brits do better, the UK Highway Code was created back in 1931. But the guide hasn't kept up with rapid development, and there's need now for something that helps create better civility on the road and overall more pleasant interactions between people. That's where Pat Brown comes in. She was on the commission on the future of London's roads and streets, and has championed the idea of introducing a new movement code for London to improve city living. To explain all, here she is.
The way we live our lives and the things that we do in the city are so very different from when we first created the Highway Code. And what's happened in London over the past 10 years is really great stuff has happened. You know, we've made pedestrians a priority, we've increased cycling, we've made cycle lanes. The problem is that we're actually taking away road space, which in one hand is a good thing, but when you're in a busy, crowded city that has to function as an economy, a place to live with quality of life, place to cycle, and to breathe good quality air, that's all quite incompatible. So we've got more and more things happening on the road in London. More people are travelling on our buses and our tubes with our lives on our backs, our window cleaning kits, our suitcases, you name it. Now, because people don't drive so much, we're taking it in our public transport. So our public transport and our streets are pretty damn full. And if you step back and think, is the Highway Code actually enabling us to use that space in the most efficient and sophisticated, empathetic way? That's when I think it's not fit for purpose. So I'm crossing a road off a main road, and I've already started crossing, and I hear a beep. Now, I know it's my right of way to continue crossing the road, but when the driver continues around the corner and expects me to get out of the way, unless I want to be killed, I have to get back on the curb. So we have to, at the very minimum, the movement code should actually be about surfacing our rights, our responsibilities, and then inviting ways in really positive through a campaign and through a whole range of sort of research and thinking and what people are doing all the time now in terms of user-centric design, thinking how do we help and encourage people to play their part in being empathetic to the needs of others and not putting themselves front and centre. When I first started to talk to my then board, Central London Partnerships Board, about legible cities and wayfinding, people said, what the hell are you talking about? And it's 10 years since Legible London. The wayfinding system that we brought into the streets came onto the streets as a prototype in Oxford Street, and now it's all over the place and people love it. But the point is that since Legible London came on stream, the world has changed dramatically, and we have to iterate our cities. We have to step back and think, what are we doing now? Is it still fit for purpose? The rules of the road as they once existed and the way we live our lives are very, very different. I think London is going through growth pains in terms of a changing pattern of movement at the moment. I suspect if we come back in 10 years' time, as more people are cycling and less people are driving naturally, as we maybe put more of our stuff into baskets and we don't necessarily go to the dry cleaners in our car or what have you, London will feel different. But we're at a tipping point in society, and tipping points, whether it's with the Luddites and machines being smashed up, are really difficult. So that disruption that people talk about is what we're dealing with at the moment. I have what I call the PLU syndrome, the people like us syndrome, and quite often people plan cities without actually thinking about diverse needs. You know, like the people who have only ever used the bus rather than the tube because they can never afford the tube. And one of the issues with the people complaining about the number of buses in Oxford Street is, for example, so many people who live in Lewisham or the old Kent Road, the New Cross Road, don't have tubes, and if they're getting to whether it's Oxford Street or the West End per se on the 4-5-3 on a wet Monday morning with their kids, and they're taking them to nursery before they then go into work. Buses are part of a system, and we have to look at why people move and then plan it much more empathetically. We did something really stupid in the 20th century. We planned our cities in awe and in love with the motor car and the fossil fuel drive. And now we realise that we did something wrong by actually putting ourselves in that position. And we've been retrofitting people walking, cycling into cities ever since, into cities that have been built around the motor car. And that's why I think we've got the pain and the disjuncture that we've got at the moment. I think most people are good people, and we don't set out to screw up each other's days. We just get into our little bubble. The mobile phone and music is actually exacerbating that. I've just spent a few moments going over Baker Street. Almost didn't make the light because quite a few people were texting as they walked across the green light and slowing that movement down. They didn't realise they were doing anything bad. They were just in their own world. So I think through a sort of campaign, through spotlighting things, through reminding people that we're all part of a bigger system, this wonderful city called London, that we just need to have each other's backs more than we currently do. The way I've suggested to TfL we start is by studying the way people move already and then working out some form of campaign, which would be a communications campaign aimed at people right across the piece. If you're at a bus stop, you can find out about highway code number 70, which explains how you cross at Pelican Crossings, for example. If you're on a tube, you can find out how to interact with cyclists. So treat us all as people who move in very different ways, who wear different hats, who need the city to work for us at all times, and communicate about what we can do to support each other.
That was Pat Brown, who's currently the chair of London Festival of Architecture, and she was talking about London's new movement code. And that's all we have for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, and it was edited by David Stevens. Join us next week as we report on sound and the city from the Resonate conference in Lisbon. And don't forget, find out more about urbanism in Monocle magazine. Every month we have several pages dedicated to the topic, so don't miss out. But to conclude this episode of The Urbanist, here's Beach House with Walk in the Park. Thank you for listening, city lovers.